Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, Pope Benedict's prayers are with rescue workers and victims of Haiti's devastating earthquake. On today's program, we'll hear about aid efforts on the ground. And following Pope Benedict's visit to Rome's synagogue, we look at a new historical exhibit on display there, a glimpse at a painful past, but with renewed hope for a brighter future in Catholic-Jewish relations. But first, Chris Altieri tells us about the introduction Tuesday in the Vatican of a working document for this year's upcoming Synod for the Church in the Middle East.
Il testo ha tre capitoli.
On Tuesday at the press office of the Holy See, the secretary for the Synod of Bishops, Archbishop Nicholas Edorovich, laid out the three-part outline of the Synod Assembly's plan of work, which will address the state of the Catholic Church in the Middle East, ecclesial communion, and Christian witness in relation to other Christians, to Jews, and to Muslims.
Di fronte a questa situazione non facile in vari paesi,
Archbishop Edorovich also explained that the lineamenta, the outline, is being sent to participants together with a detailed questionnaire, and that the responses to the 32 questions will form the basis of the Instrumentum Laboris, the working document that will guide the Synod Fathers in their work. The Special Assembly of the Synod of Bishops for the Middle East is scheduled for October of this year. I'm Chris Altieri.
One week after a magnitude 7 earthquake devastated the Caribbean island of Haiti, thousands of people are fleeing the capital of Port-au-Prince, seeking safety and food in the countryside. Some officials are now estimating 200,000 people perished and 1.5 million others are homeless. While speaking after Sunday's Angelus prayer here in Rome, Pope Benedict offered his prayers for the victims of the disaster.
Il nostro pensiero in questi giorni è rivolto alle care popolazioni di Haiti e si fa accorata preghiera.
In these days, our thoughts are turned towards the dear population of Haiti, the Pope said, as well as our heartfelt prayers. The Apostolic Nuncio, who, thanks be to God, is all right, is keeping me continually informed, and so I have learned of the sad death of the Archbishop, as well as so many priests, religious, and seminarians. The Pope continued, I am following and encouraging the efforts of numerous charity organizations that are dealing with the immense needs of the country. I am praying for the injured, for the homeless, and for those who tragically have lost their lives. The United Nations has appealed for $550 million in emergency funding, but streets are still piled with debris and rising crime are slowing aid delivery. We have this report.
At least 70,000 bodies have been confirmed buried following the Haiti earthquake. The Pan American Health Organization has estimated that at least 100,000 are dead, while a U.S. general on the ground in Haiti thinks that the death toll could reach 200,000 or higher.
The U.S. Southern Command says it aims to have 10,000 U.S. troops in the area after Haitian President René Préval appealed Sunday for additional troops to help keep order. He said police and U.N. peacekeepers are overstretched and cannot contain crowds of looters.
However, there are signs of progress as international medical teams begin to take over damaged hospitals. The church's main aid organization, Caritas Internationalis, is on the ground and reports that an emergency clinic and medical team is being flown in from Holland, with 120 tons of aid from Caritas partners on its way over land and sea.
Caritas Internationalis press officer Michelle Hoff is in Port-au-Prince. She says the distribution of aid remains a challenge and that aid agencies fear a breakdown in public order.
Many people still look in shock. Well, as you can imagine, they've come through a terrible disaster and now they're living on the streets. Their relatives and their family may still be underneath the rubble because the rescue effort is still going on, but it's very difficult with so many collapsed houses.
Now, you speak about Caritas on the ground receiving a lot of aid from Caritas partners around the world. How important is it for you that this aid continues to flow?
It is extremely important. At the moment, where we've received 8 containers, 20 truckfuls of aid, 2 plane loads are arriving today and tomorrow. However, obviously, we need to coordinate in a way that we're not overwhelmed in such a way that we can't actually store it. We're delivering food kits, hygiene kits and shelters, also medical tents and personnel who can staff the medical tents. And we've received aid from Caritas members from across the world so far. We're facing the problem, like many aid agencies, of distributing to a large number of people because there are issues of insecurity. People have been for days without food and water in some cases, not everywhere. And we're looking very carefully at where we can distribute the most quickly and in the safest possible way.
Well, disasters like the one that hit Haiti always hurt the most vulnerable and helpless people. Women, the elderly, and especially children. The UN's Children's Fund, UNICEF, is on the ground in Haiti doing what it can to help. Spokesman Patrick McCormick tells us about the challenges they face.
We have taken into account here that this is a very young population. Nearly half of the country's population is under 18. So just figure-wise, it's going to affect young people and children much more than anyone else. We're working every day to help these children, and especially children that have been separated from their families or were by themselves in the first place.
Now, of course, Haiti, before the earthquake, already had an issue of a very high number of orphans. Would you be particularly worried about orphans in situations such as this and trying to prevent them being exploited in any way or being, shall we say, overlooked in any way?
Absolutely. Number one priority, children like orphans, to make sure that they're looked after. I mean, they're found first. We see images of children walking around by themselves looking lost. We need to find these children. We need to feed them. We need to take care of them. And we need to trace their families if they do exist or some extended family. And then only after all of that will we find a way to give them some sort of permanent home.
Patrick, another issue that has been raised, the fact that people want to adopt the children of Haiti. How important is it for organisations such as UNICEF to get their message across to people perhaps who feel that they want to contribute in some way to the welfare of these children, that they do so through organisations such as UNICEF?
Well, let's be clear here. We're not an organisation that is involved in adoption. Our line is, and especially in a post-disaster period, this is just completely inappropriate. These children need to be identified, to be registered, their families traced, as I said, and then anybody wants to adopt a child, they have to go through the government, and they have to go through the correct channels which exist in all countries. And that could be something that could happen down the road, but right now, we're looking to save lives here.
For centuries, the citizens of Rome gathered along the city's ancient streets to celebrate the election of each new pope. Among them were the city's Jews, whose community dates back to the very time of Jesus himself and farther still. Today, they number 12,000. From the 12th century, Rome's Jews, like most of its other citizens, took part in the possesso, or papal enthronement processions, which wound their way from the Vatican to the Lateran Palace. From the 16th century, Rome's Jewish community was responsible for decorating the part of the route that extended from the Arch of Titus to the Colosseum. Both monuments full of symbolic and historic significance for Roman Jewry.
Throughout the centuries, hundreds and hundreds of posters were produced and exhibited, and we are lucky in that we can observe today 14 of these original posters.
Professor Amnon Linder of Hebrew University in Jerusalem had been researching the Jewish posters for the papal possesso celebrations for several years and had just published a report on his findings when he received a call from Rome. 14 of the posters he had been studying as copies or through written accounts had been discovered in the archives of Rome's synagogue, just in time for Pope Benedict XVI's visit in January 2010. He could hardly contain his excitement as he was asked to speak at the opening of a special exhibit of the posters of papal ceremonies dating from the mid to late 18th century.
The Jewish community of Rome had a role to play in the coronation ceremonials of the popes, at least since the 12th century. Our first indications are from the beginning of the 12th century. It might have begun a bit earlier, but since the 12th century, the Roman community actually welcomed the Pope on his coronation procession, which went from the Vatican to the Lateran, and at a certain point in this procession, the chief rabbi, as they say, a multitude of Jews, a crowd of Jews, welcomed the Pope and presented him with the Torah scrolls. And the rabbi said a certain formula. The Pope answered, and then the cavalcade continued on its way to the Lateran. Now, this went on with obviously a few exceptions when the popes were not present in Rome, especially the Avignon exile. This went on until the 15th century. From the 16th century, the role of the Jews changed in this specific context and consisted in decorating the road where the procession went from the Arch of Titus to the Colosseum. This was a sort of a Jewish enclave. The Jews probably were not present there personally themselves, but they decorated the road with rich carpets, with poems of gratulations and inscriptions, festive inscriptions, and 50 posters on both sides of the road, 25 on each side. And these posters consisted of emblemata, which means a picture with a motto and a quotation from the Bible. These are biblical quotations in Hebrew and in Latin translation with a precise, exact reference to the source.
And what does this one say here in Hebrew in Latin?
Now, here you have the emblem shows the eagle looking at the crown, which is obviously a symbol of majesty, of sovereignty, the crown. The eagle itself is an emblem of sovereignty. And the eagle is looking at the crown, and the Hebrew quotation, appropriately enough, says, Hinei kanesher yale, eche kvazi akvila askendet, will rise up like an eagle. And the quotation is from Jeremiah. If you can look at this poster, for example, we have another one with an eagle, which was a very favorite symbol with the emblemata painters, and especially with in these posters. And you can see that the eagle is looking at the sun. He is looking straight at the sun. And this is a very well-known symbol of legendary ability of the eagle. The eagle is the only animal that can look at the sun directly without blinking. So this is a sort of majesty looking at majesty. And obviously they are of the same essence. That's why he can look straight at the sun. And that's why, by the way, the eagle was the symbol of the Apostle John. because as we know, the gospel, according to John, starts with the divine truth. At the beginning was the word. I mean, look straight at the truth, at the divine truth. That's why John is always, till today, symbolized, represented by the eagle.
How did the Roman Jewish community decide which symbols to use when they were painting these posters?
Well, I did some research on this, and because the corpus of emblemata that was in use since the 16th century is enormous throughout Europe, Alciatus, others, and it is striking to find that actually the emblemata used in these posters, in the coronation posters, were original to the Jewish community. That means that Jewish, I'm not sure about the artists, might be Jews, might not, but the conception, the idea that the emblem had to express was original to the Jewish planners. They actually planned it, and they chose the symbols. Some symbols were quite simple. I mean, if the name of the Pope, like Clemens the 13th, was Clemens, and he came from the noble house of Della Torre. So obviously you can expect to find towers. It depends on the coat of arms of the new Pope.
I know it wasn't an easy relationship between the papacy and Rome's Jewish community. This was a sign, I understand, in a sense, of their loyalty, expressing their loyalty to the Pope, as all the other Romans were asked to do. Would you say that those times are long gone? We've been able to put history behind us?
Oh, certainly, certainly. What is striking about these encounter between Pope and Rabbi during the coronation ceremony is the fact that actually you observe a subject declaring his loyalty to a ruler. So the political aspect in this ceremonial is overwhelming, although it is also a religious ceremony, but it's in the first place a political ceremony. Now, the political aspect of subjection, and the Jews were subjects, like everywhere else in Europe, but here in Rome they were subject to religious authority, not only political, but an authority that was at the same time political and religious, which made things usually much more complicated than, let's say, in a medieval or Renaissance monarchy like France or England.
Was it the most difficult period from about 300 years in the 1500s to the 1800s?
It was very difficult. It was a very difficult period, but I must say that the medieval centuries were not easy for the Jews either. They were in a very difficult position, very difficult situation. They had to accept some sort of tolerant protection in order to exist. And this tolerant protection depended, obviously, on political, religious circumstances, on the personal attitudes of the reigning pope. And the situation got worse during the Counter-Reformation papacy. If you, for example, in the 13th century, there was some sort of traditional tolerant protection accorded to the Jews, which almost disappeared during the Counter-Reformation, when the papacy became much more militant on the religious front, obviously, for obvious reasons, against the Protestant heresy. And the Jews found it much more difficult to exist as a separate religious heresy within the very center of the Catholic world. And so, obviously, 16th, 17th, 18th century were quite difficult, quite difficult. I would say that even the very fact that the Jews did not take an active role in this encounter is indicative of this complex situation. They almost didn't exist. Their existence was a sort of virtual one, represented by posters, by decorations, but not them themselves. In a way, it's like the virtual existence, the almost non-existence of Jews during the three holy days before Easter. They were, as you know, even in the Middle Ages, well, beginning with the Middle Ages, they were not allowed to go out in the streets. They had to stay at home, not to, well, it was a measure of protection as well. But it is indicative of their difficult situation.
The difficult situation was not to really change for Rome's Jewish community until about the year 1870, when the Italian army declared war on the Papal States. But advances in relations between the Church and Jews have since increased the respect each holds for the other, leading to the visits by two popes to Rome's synagogue. First, Pope John Paul II, and later, Pope Benedict XVI.
The whole tone, mode of relationship between the papacy and the Jews in Rome changed, as we have seen with the Pope's visit to the synagogue. Now, this was not a visit of a sovereign who comes to visit his subjects. This was a visit. This is a sort of relationship that exists between two very close religions, two religions that have common grounds and common roots, but the one does not depend on the other. And this opens the way, as the Pope said, of a frank and open dialogue between two religions that are, by definition, independent, autonomous, and therefore can talk to each other. And the whole atmosphere is completely different.
So your feeling is that we've overcome a lot of the differences, or at least we've overcome some of our problems, and we're now ready to face the future, putting our past behind us.
To a sort of outside observer coming from Israel, it's obviously not for me to speak for my co-religionist in Rome, but looking from outside, yes, that was my impression. And as one member of the Jewish rabbinical delegation to the dialogue that is going on said, it's striking, you know, the medieval representation of the relation between synagogue and ecclesia was the two women standing facing each other, the ecclesia with the chalice of the communion in her hands and looking straight forward, you know, proud gaze, and in front of her, the synagogue, a humiliated woman, her eyes blindfolded. She prefers not to see, not because she's blind, she was born. No, she doesn't want to see. And she tries to hold in her hands the tablets of the law, which are falling down to earth. The very picture of humiliation, of defeat. And as my colleague said, we heard the Pope actually emphasizing the importance of the tablets of the law, which are held in the hands of the synagogue. So this symbol obviously has been changed, and quite dramatically, when Christians actually look, I wouldn't say up to the synagogue, but look with appreciation and with respect to the fact that the synagogue is still holding on to the tablets of the law. And he emphasized it quite clearly, no doubt about that.
As Pope John Paul II, his predecessor, said in that very synagogue, the Jews are our elder brothers.
Yes, and you know that even this, I mean, he meant it, obviously, with no arrière-pensée, as they say in French. But, you know, this has been interpreted quite differently. because the elder brother, in the biblical sense, is not a very promising simile, because the elder brother was Ishmael or Esau, and it was always the youngest brother who got the promise and the alliance, Jacob, Isaac. So eldest brother at that time, I remember, was in a way accepted with some reservation. I'm sure it wasn't the intention.
No, I'm sure it wasn't the intention, because in the Christian world, we look up to our older brothers as teaching us, as going down the road ahead of us and paving the way for the rest of us who come afterwards.
Yes, but looking back at the biblical stories, the eldest brother was not always the lucky one between the two.
Though you do see a warming of relations.
That has been my impression, yes, and speaking with the members of the Vatican establishment, and that's a feeling I get, and it's time that the two religions go back to where they were in the first century AD, when Christianity was still part of Judaism, and Judaism encompassed Christianity before the roads parted. Obviously, we have two religions, and each religion holds on to its truth, but relationships can be better than they were during hundreds of years of, not always, but very frequently, of persecution, humiliation. And now that we don't have the political aspect, the political factor in this relationship, I think that we can hope for a better future.
We were talking about Rome as an ancient city, and we were talking also about the painful history that the Jews here and Christians, the early Christians, had a very difficult time here in the ancient city of Rome. But sometimes I feel that people aren't ready to put away this past. They're not ready to sweep it aside and work together for a better, brighter future together.
I think that, on the contrary, you have to remember the past in order, actually, to get together and arrive at some sort of coexistence with memories, which are painful, but still they exist, and they make us what we are. Without our past, we won't have our present. And these memories actually should motivate us to do things right, to find some sort of accommodation with erstwhile enemies, with erstwhile persecutors, with erstwhile persecuted. Without that, we won't be able to do anything. On the contrary, the past is here to teach us what not to do and what to do right.
And a warm thanks there to Amnon Linder, a retired professor emeritus at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.